So, we have been discussing different aspects of yoga, and this is the concluding session. And of course, weather is changing, that could be one reason why not many are able to come. But if you have got any subjects to suggest, we'll discuss the topic. Otherwise, I shall go back to the concluding part of this discussion. Those who have been listening, if you have any topic which you want me to clarify, to describe more elaborately, you can just. I've been discussing the four aspects of yoga. The path of philosophical inquiry, which is called Jnana Yoga, and the path of devotion to a personal God, Bhakti Yoga, and the path of action, the method of unselfish action, which is technically called Karma Yoga, and the path of psychic control, which is called Raj Yoga. There are a few more aspects to be dealt with on Raj Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. So, if you have no special topics for clarification, I shall go back to the subject. Now, one point which Swami Vivekananda makes clear in his yoga lectures is this. He says yoga helps you to speed up our evolutionary process. Now, as a prelude to this statement, may I state before you a very important historical truth, that it is Swami Vivekananda who brought this concept of yoga to Western world. This is a very important aspect of any discussion on yoga that we engage in America. Because the very concept of yoga was introduced to modern Western world by Swami Vivekananda during his lectures in the last decade of 19th century, from 1893 onwards. Swamiji worked almost for 4 years here. And during the course of his writings and his speeches and lectures, he dealt with different aspects of yoga, all the four yogas. And during his conversations and lectures, one important point that he mentions is that yoga speeds up the evolutionary process. He says, see, biological evolution or evolution at the physical level has come to an end now. Now you cannot evolve further. There is no scope for any further evolution. He is referring to Darwinian concept of evolution. Now that he neither fully accepts it nor rejects it. But in relation to that concept, he says the process of evolution at the physical level, at the biological level, is not completed. There is no scope for going beyond the present level. Now, but there is another kind of evolution and progress, and that is at the cultural level, at the value level. Because as human beings, we are all the same from a physiological point of view. But from a cultural point of view, spiritual point of view, we are entirely different. We belong to different levels of evolution. So Swamiji says the entire humanity can be divided into four groups. Those who are prone to action, and those who are of a contemplative type, philosophically, of an advanced type, and then those who are more of a more interested in deep thinking. And then those who think that spiritual life is not possible without focusing on a personal God, a creator God. So these are the four levels of, four aspects of yoga which he calls. So the entire humanity, not only spiritual seekers, the whole of humanity can be divided into these four categories. There is nobody in the world who doesn't belong to one of these four categories. And these four yogas are meant for the entire humanity. So, when he explains this, his first statement is that a human being is potentially divine. This is the first, the true nature of human being. The human being is not a biological or physical or psychophysical mechanism. Is or she is beyond, is something other than, something beyond the psychophysical mechanism. This body is only a vehicle, just the most insignificant part of the whole of human mechanism. The body belongs to a higher reality, which he calls soul, which he calls Atman, using the Sanskrit term, which he takes from the Vedic or Upanishadic texts. So human being is nothing but a soul with a body. That's what he says. A soul which owns a body. And this body is subject to change. But the soul remains eternal. So all the human beings, the seven billion human beings, are 7 billion reflections of this Atman, of this consciousness, this reality. So Atman is the one reality which is immanent in all beings, which is all-pervading, which is omnipresent, which is transcendental, and which never perishes. It doesn't have a beginning, therefore it can never have an end. It is eternal. But this body comes and goes. So body is just a reflection. This electricity is all pervading. Maybe this bulb is one mechanism through which man exposes. Then depending upon the medium through which expresses, its quality, its utility changes. So, that's one point. Second point is, the entire purpose of human life is to manifest, to fully express this reality. So, the first point is that his own sentence is man is potentially divine. Means man or woman, human beings are potentially divine. So, one important point is, there is no distinction between God and man, you can say. Extending further, and in his more forceful rhetoric style, Vivekananda said in later years, that man is God himself. It may look quite blasphemous or sacrilegious on the face of it. But why? Because God is the reality, the spiritual reality, and this godly divine spirit is manifest in all living beings. Then why are we so different from our idea of God, our idea of the divine, the consciousness? That's because we are not aware of it. So there is, on the one hand, there is the truth, the reality that we are potentially divine. On the other hand, there is the reality that we are not aware of. We are ignorant of it. Now he says, the purpose of religion is to create this awareness within us. To manifest this awareness within us. And this is possible through four different paths. which he calls four different yogas. So when we are selfish in our actions, in the performance of duties and responsibilities, we are not aware of the divine reality within us. So if we become unselfish in all our actions, then we start manifesting this inner potential divinity through the process of action. It is called Karma Yoga. This is what I was trying to explain here in this. So you have to connect this in this manner. First, but you have to remember, when Vivekananda speaks of a God or a divine, you should not confuse his idea of God with the monotheistic concept of a creator God who creates this world and sits apart from this world. His idea of a God is the divine principle which is immanent, omnipresent and transcendent. This is the idea which is all-pervading. It is a God, the divine, which is present everywhere. So there is no question of belief or non-belief or accepting or non-accepting or anything. It is that everyone should try to manifest this divinity within. That this is possible even without the help of religion, even with the help of organized religions. And this manifestation of the inner potential is what he defines as the true core, the true essence of the core of religion, which he calls spirituality. And then the third important point is, he defines religion as spirituality. It's a very, very important point that we remember. It is a rebel. You know, those of you who may be students of history of religions, comparative study of religions, you'll be struck by the fact that Vivekananda was practically giving in altogether a new revolutionary concept of religion and spirituality and God. So world was concerned. So far, the Vedantic tradition is concerned, Swami Vivekananda was just giving a modern interpretation of the ideas enshrined in the ancient Vedantic texts like the Upanishads, Gita, Vedanta, the works of Great Shankaracharya, the great commentator, and so on. He was just giving a new interpretation in modern English language. That's what it is. But so far as the world was concerned, it was a new revolutionary concept. Just think of the age in which Swami Vivekananda brought this idea of yoga to Western world. You know, his first speech took place in 1893, September 11. That's the first half of the last decade of 19th century. And that was a particular age, a very peculiar age. Any student of religion or history of religion or comparative religion will be surprised at the revolutionary change that he brought about in the history of religions. One point was, that was an age when religion was slowly taking a back seat in the intellectual discussions of educated people. People started looking upon religion as something essentially dogmatic, based on some psychological obsessions. You believe in this particular entity who creates this world, who rewards you, who punishes you according to your actions with hell or heaven and so on. So that was the idea of God which was prevalent during those days. And then Karl Marx came and he said this religion is anti-humanistic, and he gave one blow. Then Darwin came, he said this religion doesn't agree with the discoveries of modern science and technology. And many modern thinkers, neo-positivists and others, and modern scientists and technologists, so they all started challenging this belief system, which stressed the fact that God is the creator of the world, and that God is the one who rewards you if you obey him and punishes you if you disobey him. If he punishes, he sends you to hell, and if he rewards, he sends you to heaven, and so on. Now, in this intellectual historical scene, Swami Vivekananda brought this concept of yoga. And this said, while interpreting yoga, he said, religion is not faith, religion is not just belief, religion is not doctrine or dogma. Belief either in a book or in a priestcraft or in a temple or a church or any place of worship, nothing. These are all helpful in religious life. Religion is not opposed to this. Religion may include all this, but religion goes beyond that. And then he said, religion is spirituality. Religion is the translation of the universal spiritual ideas into the totality of our existence. And it should reflect in our actions, in our beliefs, in every aspect of our daily existence. So he said, religion is a manifestation of divinity already in man. It's a very, very simple, but it's a revolutionary definition which he gave to religion. See, religion is the manifestation of divinity already in man. So, on the one hand, the whole definition is built upon the concept that a human being is basically divine. And what is divinity? Divinity is God himself. So, this divinity is inherent in all living beings. You don't have to seek it outside of you. When you turn your inquiry inward, then when you try to express and manifest the divinity by good actions, good feelings, good thoughts, and holy living, then this religion really begins in our life, it enters our life, then it becomes a part of our life, then it is spirituality. It is not faith or belief or anything, or dogmas or anything. But you have to remember, he doesn't deny the role of beliefs, concepts, rituals, either going to temple, church, or any place of worship, holy books. All these do have a place in religious life. He doesn't reject them outright, not at all. But these only constitute the essence of religion. Vivekananda's words, if I may call, they constitute the kindergarten of spiritual life. It's a very famous statement. So doctrines, beliefs, ideas, concepts, rituals, conventions, customs, all. They all are necessary, but they constitute only the beginning, the kindergarten of spiritual life. One should go beyond this. Now, and then he said, the gradual manifestation of this inner divinity is the true purpose, the true goal, the real scope of religion and spirituality. And this is possible either by practicing karma yoga, which I already explained, the path of unselfish action. Karma yoga, or through philosophical inquiry, what is the true nature of my personality, who am I in reality, what's the meaning of life and what's the meaning of existence, what is the origin of the universe. So one could make this inquiry through meditation, through introspection, through deep thinking. One could go ahead with this inquiry. And then he or she will realize that we are something beyond this body, beyond this psychophysical mechanisms. We are the all-pervading, immanent spirit. This he called Jnana Yoga, the path of wisdom, philosophical inquiry. And then we have got the Bhakti Yoga. So this inner divinity can be brought out, it could be expressed by following the doctrines and teachings of great religious teachers with devotion. We can pray to a god, we can worship a god, we can read sacred scriptures with great devotion and concentration. That is also one path. But then, this should be done with a definite view in mind. That is, the God that we are praying to is in fact the omnipresent reality. He's not just one who creates this world and sits apart from the world. He is the one who is omnipresent, immanent, everywhere. And this he calls the path of devotion, which is technically called the Bhakti Yoga. So, and remember, in all religious traditions, these ideas can be found. In every religious tradition, all these ideas can be found. There may be some ideas also, narrow-mindedness or dogmatic ideas may be found, but Swamiji says they are only aberrations, they are only deviations, they are only the exceptions. But in reality, in all religions, you can find this path of wisdom, path of unselfish action, and path of devotion. And the fourth yoga that he interpreted was the path of psychic control. It's called Raja Yoga. By practicing some general and specific disciplines, inner and outer disciplines, external and internal disciplines, one can practice spirituality. One can bring out this inner potential, inner divinity. And while describing this, he spoke about the five specific disciplines and five general disciplines. See, non-violence, truthfulness, then absence of greed, absence of desire for things which belong to others, then purity, chastity, and then complete freedom from any selfish desire for things that do not belong to us. All these are general disciplines which one could follow. Non-violence is not just abstinence from violent actions. Non-violence is altogether an attitude of mind, an attitude of our life, a philosophy of life. We should be completely free from any violent thought, emotion, deed or anything. And then keeping the mind, word, deed, actions, everything on a straight line. Speaking what we have in mind, and doing things in accordance with our words and thoughts. So thought, word and deed, they should be in a single line, which is called truthfulness. And inner contentment, absence of greed. And then five specific disciplines: contentment, purity, then the habit of reading sacred books, feeding the mind, our mind, with holy ideas, spiritually elevating ideas, and then a general, friendly, universal, tolerant attitude towards the entire creation. These are the disciplines which are helpful in the path of psychic control, so Raja Yoga. So these are the four paths. And if we sincerely follow these four paths, we can gradually evolve in the path of spiritual life. Now, here again, Swami Vivekananda, while interpreting the yoga, said there are four levels of evolution in spiritual life. And he says this can be found in all religious traditions. It is not special or peculiar to Vedantic tradition or yoga tradition. He said, at the grossest level, at the primary level, we follow certain customs, conventions and practices. See, a person goes to a particular place of worship according to the religious tradition into which he is born, in which he was trained right from his early days. Accordingly, he may read certain books, he may believe in certain customs and cultures and conventions, and accordingly, weekly or daily, he may follow certain mechanical practices, going to a place of worship, etc. Believe in a dogma, in doctrine, in what is called, you know, in certain traditionally transmitted belief systems. This is very good, but this is only the primary stage in the evolutionary process of any spiritual seeker. And he says, the problem with humanity is, this is very often looked upon as the end of yogic life, of spiritual life. In fact, it is only the beginning of spiritual life. Belief in a particular customs, a set of traditions, dogmas and doctrines may be necessary, may be helpful even, because they keep us, they keep our mind close to some transcendental ideas. That's true. But at this stage, there is always a distance between a seeker and his goal. He has not started manifesting the inner divinity within. He has only entered the first stage of the evolutionary process. So, this is what he calls, you know, it's called rituals. So rituals constitute the primary stage. And then he says mythology. Mythologies are mostly stories and legends, many of them without any historical proof or background, and some of them may have grains of truth in them. Legends which gradually develop in societies and cultures and different religious groups, which many people believe blindly, many people do not, of course. Now, Swamiji says, mythology is only an attempt to justify rituals. There is also a bit of truth in that. But mythology, again, is only an attempt to reach a higher goal. It is not the end of the journey. It is only an attempt to reach a higher goal. And he says, at the level of rituals and mythology, there can be no unity between different religious traditions. You can very easily see. Depending upon our religious belief, people go to different places of worship. Legends and stories and mythologies also normally develop around the customs and rituals that we follow. At the third stage, just still higher stage, Swamiji says, there are many common spiritual ideas found in all religious spiritual traditions, and this is the stage of philosophy. When you reach the level of the third level of philosophy, you can find there are many common philosophical ideas in all religious traditions. Many ideas which are common to all religious traditions and belief systems. See, ontologically, we conceive of a supreme being who is absolute reality. And also, there is an ethical framework that we evolve that help us to realize this ontological reality. So, in certain ideas with relation to metaphysics, ontology or ethics, or even in epistemology, the theory of knowledge, the proofs that we use to establish a doctrine. In all these ideas, you find there are many commonalities. There are Many of these ideas are common to various religious traditions and belief systems. Here also, there is not complete unity. There are differences between different religious spiritual traditions, even at the philosophical level. But there are many ideas which are common to all religious and philosophical ideas which are common to all faith systems. Now, beyond philosophy, there is a still higher stage, the fourth stage, which is the stage of experience. And Swami Vivekananda stresses the point, when a spiritual seeker transcends the first three stages of rituals, mythology and philosophy and reach the level of inner experience, the real experience, the stage in which he or she manifests the inner divinity within, at that stage there is complete unity, because all liberated souls, all spiritually elevated persons speak of the same experience. Maybe the language, the phraseology, the vocabulary they may use in expressing these ideas may differ, but the inner content is the same. And according to Swami Vivekananda, to reach this level of experience, we have these four paths: the path of action, the path of wisdom, the path of devotion, and the path of psychic control. Depending upon our own temperament, we can reach this level of the highest intuitive experience. So, I was trying to explain during the last five classes, and even earlier also in the 10 classes on the Upanishads, how different spiritual seekers, depending upon their temperament, can follow one, two, all the four, or at least one of these paths and can reach the supreme goal. This was the gist of what I was trying to explain during the last few classes. Now, if you have got any further clarifications, you can ask. Otherwise, we will conclude the class. This is the last session of this class. So, because we have already covered all the topics that we had planned to cover. If there is any subject for discussion, you can put forward some ideas in a general way.
Swamiji, could I ask regarding karma yoga, how does karma yoga by itself, without bringing in a divinity, without bringing in metaphysics, how does karma yoga manage to reach that highest state?
Yes. Of course, from one point of view, we will find if you follow any one of these four paths, you will be simultaneously following some aspects of the other three paths as well. You cannot approach these four paths as totally separate paths leading to the same goal. They are not watertight compartments. So when we follow the path of karma, for example, the path of selfless action, we will have to learn the method of or the philosophy of selfless action from some source, and that will overlap with the path of philosophy, no doubt about it. Why should we be selfless in this world? The question arises. Vivekananda discussed this point. In fact, he devotes a lot of his writings to this topic. What is the foundation of selflessness in life? And then Interestingly, he makes a comparative study of different schools of thoughts, which are prevalent during his times, and he takes up this subject of utilitarianism, according to J.S. Mill, John Stuart Mill, Jeremy Bentham, and others, European thinkers. Now, J.S. Mill says that any action which brings maximum amount of pleasure, happiness, empirical happiness to maximum number of people is valid. So the validity or the relevance of any action should be judged on the basis of the amount of pleasure, amount of practical benefit it brings to people. Now, if you take this idea, there is no scope for karma yoga, the path of selfless action. Because selfishness is very beneficial, apparently. From a superficial point of view, selfishness is the most practical, the most result-oriented, and the most useful policy, approach towards actions. And unselfishness involves a lot of uncertainties. Apparently, unselfishness doesn't produce any immediate result. Selfish action very often produce immediate result. So utilitarian theory cannot be the basis of ethics, that is. Then what is the basis of ethics in selfless action? So Swami Vivekananda says that it is the fact that reality is one, humanity is one spiritual entity, the entire humanity is one spiritual family. Therefore, if we are selfish, and if our selfish attitude hurts another person, we are thereby hurting ourselves. Because humanity is one. The entire humanity is one spiritual family. It is a divine principle, the consciousness itself. Basically, consciousness is present in all living beings, not only in human beings, even entire the animal creation, even nature. According to Upanishad philosophy, not only human beings, so the animal kingdom, even the planets, the trees, the mountains, valleys, all these are the manifestations of divine. Not that they are God. Please don't misunderstand. Upanishad does not say tree is God, or mountain is God, or river is God. What it says is, all these phenomena exist because of the Supreme Consciousness. Because there can be no existence independent of the Supreme Reality. So, in one of the most celebrated Rigvedic mantras, in Prithivi Shanti, Antariksham Shanti, Dyau Shanti, you can find the life. See, let the earth, the heavens, the skies, and in some other mantras, in the moons and stars and the sun, let all of them be peaceful. Let entire humanity be peaceful. Let the whole animal kingdom be peaceful. Let the forest, mountains, the constellation of stars, the sky, everything be peaceful. All these manifest. All these manifest and they express the divinity of one supreme consciousness. These such mantras, such hymns and prayers you can find in the Vedic literature. So, the path of selfless action, karma yoga, is closely linked to the idea that existence is one, spiritually one. So, the idea that the entire existence is one spiritual entity is related to philosophy. It is related to the path of Jnana Yoga. That is the very basis of Jnana Yoga. But so, each yoga is linked to the other three yogas as well. You cannot follow one path independently. But depending upon the temperament of spiritual seekers, he or she can follow one of the four paths. Because in all of us, there is one characteristic which is the dominant characteristic. See, some people are more oriented towards action. They may have philosophical ideas, they may have devotional ideas, they may have ideas which make them suitable for other paths also. But this particular idea, this particular temperament is the dominant characteristic of an individual. That is, he is or she is more action-oriented. In that case, that person can follow Karma Yoga. So Karma Yoga can never be completely separated from other three yogas. Again, you know, a person who follows unselfish action, the path of unselfish action, selfless action, naturally will be contented. See, discontentment or anxiety, dissatisfaction, all these are related to our strong desire, obsessive desire for the result of our action, and too much attachment. So, a person who follows the path of action, in reality, he detaches his mind from any unselfish motive or desire. So he becomes calm and quiet. And this tranquility of mind is an integral part of the path of Raja Yoga, the path of psychic control. So the path of Karma Yoga is linked to the path of Raja Yoga also. Not different. Again, many of the great men who practice unselfish action are great devotees. Not all of them. Buddha did not believe in God. He was perhaps one of the greatest practitioners of Karma Yoga the world has seen. He did not believe in a God or anything. But there have been great Karma Yoga, like Gandhi. He was a great believer in God. So, there have been great men who followed the path of Karma Yoga. They were also great devotees. And at the same time, they also displayed in their character the calmness, the equanimity of a person who follows the path of Raja Yoga. And also, they had some strong philosophical convictions, which are the predominant characteristics of those who follow the path of Jnana Yoga. So, in other words, all these paths are interlinked. But the one distinguishing factor is that a seeker may have one particular characteristic which is dominant in him. Either he may be inclined towards the path of devotion more than any other paths. Or he may be inclined towards the path of wisdom, or the path of psychic control, Raja Yoga, or the path of unselfish action. That's any point of discussion? Now, there is a special reason why I refer to Swami Vivekananda, because the very idea of yoga and Vedanta was introduced to the Western world by Swami Vivekananda. The very idea of the universalism of spirituality, religion, all this originate from that time. That's why I stress this point. So I thought this is a concluding session, so I thought it is very appropriate if we could conclude the last session with some references to Swami Vivekananda's contribution.
Swamiji, is there an assumption that somewhere in the our practice of yoga, whichever yoga it is, is there an assumption that somewhere along that path something will come in to bring a new light? In other words, that there is an entry of course, if you believe in God, you think it's God that is appearing to you. But in any of these yogas, at some point, is it true that this something spiritual, that is to say, not physical, not psychological, some other element enters and changes the scene?
Yes. In all the four yogas, there is one important element which we start experiencing within. That is a sense of inner contentment, which is called in Sanskrit, very technical word is santosha, which actually means a kind of all-pervading, inexplicable, inner sense of contentment. You feel that you are on the right track, and you feel you have achieved something which you cannot achieve at the empirical level through any of these worldly means. It is not satisfaction. Satisfaction is related to achieving something which is peripheral, which we may lose next day. You may want to buy something. If you buy that, you get satisfied. But then if it's a furniture, the furniture gets damaged, that satisfaction goes. But here, there's an inner sense of contentment, blissfulness. As you enter the path of any of the four yogas, and as you sincerely follow, and you travel some distance, as you progress a little, slowly you feel a kind of inner contentment. You won't be interested in anything else. You feel an inner feeling that we are on the right track. You find this even in the writings of some of the great mystics, some of them, Philokalia, and all that, find an inner contentment. Brother Lawrence books, Lord. In Indian, in India's Vedantic devotional literature, there are scores of works which describe the experiences of great devotees who felt a sense of inner contentment, an inner blissfulness, which is beyond description, beyond explanation. And which keeps them on that track for the rest of their life. You can't tempt them with any worldly rewards or anything. They won't deviate from their path. They feel that this is the right path. It's difficult to explain, but an inner sense of contentment, blissfulness. And this is common in all the four paths. In all the four paths. In fact, many of the great writers, devotional philosophers and Vedantic philosophers, they say, this is one proof that you are progressing. One important proof that you are progressing, in the path of yoga is that you are not suffering from anxiety neurosis, you don't complain about the world, and you are not worried about about your own future, and you feel an inner joy. That's why spiritual life is a matter of inner joy. An unhappy expression and spirituality will not go together. That is why in the Gita, in the 12th chapter, you know, when Lord Krishna describes the characteristics of a great devotee, the first symptom of a great devotee that he refers to is Sandushta Satadam Yogi Yatatma Dridhanishchaya. Sandushta means somebody who is always experiencing that inner joy, the inner contentment, the inner blissfulness. Sandushta means. So a devotee here, a devotee or a yogi, a spiritual seeker, he may be following the path of Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja, any of the yoga. He will have a sense of inner joy, contentment. Why do you worry about anything? What is there to worry about? So worry is always related to a kind of inner feeling of imperfection. You want something, that's why you are worried. So an inner want, inner dissatisfaction, an inner misery is the real cause of worry and anxiety. So the first sign of a great yogi or a great bhakta means a seeker who follows the path of yoga, the yogi, or a seeker who follows the path of devotion is a bhakta, or a seeker who follows the path of wisdom, or a seeker who follows the path of action, unselfish action, is that he will be free, completely free from any kind of anxiety, complaint, dissatisfaction. So, an all-pervading inner sense of joy and contentment is the first sign of a spiritual seeker. Again, I can explain this in the light of one incident in the life of Vivekananda. So, you know, Swami Vivekananda lived in America for many years. So once one of his hosts asked him, Vivekananda was very free, you know, he was always in a state of ecstasy most of the time when he gave lectures, when he presented his papers, important sessions, or maybe two classes for his disciples. He was always in a state of ecstatic joy. Now, in those days, you know, the senior theologians and religious thinkers, they were supposed to be always they were always supposed to have a grim expression on their face, no nonsense attitude, always serious, not cutting jokes or anything in their talks or lectures. They were supposed to have always a very serious expression on their face. 19th century, when we're talking about. That is the tradition in those days, senior theologians and religious leaders. So somebody asked Swami Vivekananda, why are you always... Then Swami Vivekananda said, you know, I feel pain only when I have some stomach problem. He said, because there is no other need for me to feel miserable. A true spiritual aspirant need not feel miserable. He always feels a kind of inner joy, inner satisfaction, inner blissfulness. It is not the childish happiness or mirthfulness of an ordinary person who gets something and who is happy about it. No. Is the inner blissfulness, joy or happiness or contentment. It's a total philosophy of life. It is not a feeling, it is a total philosophy of life, an attitude of life. This is the first sign that all great spiritual seekers experience as they progress for some distance in any of the four paths. In fact, as you know, as you get freed from the chains that bind to you, the previous karmas, you feel more and more joy. What our devotee is referring to is this. You know, Swami Vivekananda said that every unselfish action has the effect of liberating you from the shackles that bind you to your old karmas, old actions and old memories. So it releases you from another bondage. Every unselfish action leads to your liberation from one or other binding shackles. That's idea. And as you get released from this bondage, its outer expression is that you feel an inner joy or happiness or blissfulness. which in fact it is this blissfulness which all of us are seeking. When people go for entertainments, they are actually trying to get a little of this joy or this inner contentment. Only they are knocking at the wrong door. They are ringing the wrong number. That's all. So if you go to watch a football game to enjoy a little, to have a little enjoyment, you do not realize at that moment that the joy which the football game gives you will not be everlasting. Once the game is over, the old condition will return. But that we forget when we go for it. So consciously or unconsciously, every human effort to transcend the empirical, the visible, is an unconscious search for this inner joy or contentment. But instead of turning towards any of the four yogas, we are only turning towards the wrong directions. We are trying to seek this eternal joy or blissfulness in places and things which cannot give us this. That's all. But we forget that. This is what is happening. When you read poetry, we are trying to go beyond the present of empirical. It gives you liberation for the time being, but then it cannot give you eternal peace or happiness. The previous condition will return to the mind, but that we don't remember at that moment. So these four yogas are actually the four royal paths which anyone can follow. But there are certain prerequisites, certain inner and outer disciplines that we have to follow, which will lead us to eternal peace and blissfulness. So if anyone feels that inner joy after traveling some distance along the route, along this path, it only shows that he is on the right track, he is progressing. So we can conclude now?
One more question, Swamiji.
Okay.
In this system of yoga, then, what, when one says God in terms of bhakti yoga, what is the definition or the most general definition of God, or what is the what the word God refers to specifically?
Yes, and in fact this definition comes in Ramanuja's Visishtadvaita philosophy. The God in the qualified non-dualistic system, God is defined as the embodiment of all auspiciousness, all that is great, sublime, beautiful, sagala, kalyana, guna, niti in Sanskrit is called, means a repository for all that is auspicious, grand, great, beautiful and sublime. A God who listens to us, who is merciful to us, whose compassion is universal, who has a soft corner even for those who do not even accept Him. Vedantic God is not very particular that you should pray to Him. If we lead a good life, that God is God. God listens to you. That is the uniqueness of this, because He is all compassionate. So that's why in that bhakti tradition there is a statement in Sanskrit, Bhavagrahi Janardhanaha. Janardhana is one of the synonyms of God. Bhavagrahi means the one who understands your mind. What is going on in your mind? If you are sincere, And if we try to lead a good virtuous life, then God will, then we have entry to his God's kingdom. He opens his doors. All people, even those who do not believe, who do not proclaim their, who do not profess their faith or belief in that particular God, if that person lives a virtuous spiritual life, that God is mercy. So that God is defined as the all-merciful, all-compassionate repository of all conceivable auspicious characteristics and qualities and attributes. That is the definition. That is the definition you find in Ramanuja. Ramanuja was a Greek philosopher who is the exponent of qualified non-dualistic system of philosophy, which is known technically known as Vishishta Advaita, one school of Vedanta. The most popular school after Advaita, after non-dualistic school, is this qualified non-dualistic school. It's called Ramanuja's Vishishta Advaita philosophy. But God is defined as universal in compassion, in mercy, in kindness, and repository of all auspicious qualities and characteristics. Oh. You conclude with this? So I'm very happy to have been able to share my views with all of you. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tatsa Sri Ramakrishna.